Katie Heindel joins me to talk about Jimmy Butler's empathy, Jeremy Sohan's courage, and libraries. All that and more is coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. Things need not have happened to be true. Tales and dreams are the shadow truths that will endure when mere facts are dust and ashes and forgot. John Gennaro, count me in! Today's first words belong to Dream of the Endless, a.k.a. Morpheus, from Neil Gaiman's The Sandman, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and this camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, canine regularity. We don't need to get too deep into this, but Luger the premium boy, my 11-year-old pit bull who is behind this camera right now, has been having some tummy troubles, and he recently returned to keeping meals down and producing, shall we say, a firmer product. So we are so back, it's all good. And number three, even more important than all of that, I get to spend part of my morning with someone that I admire and respect a great deal. My guest today is a fantastic writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, Vice, Slam, The Athletic, and with our Up North pals at Yahoo Sports Canada. She is also the purveyor of the wonderful newsletter Basketball Feelings, where she aims to, quote, reconcile real life with basketball and expound on the less quantifiable stuff like loving a sport with problems. Her singular work at Basketball Feelings has earned recognition as one of Substack's featured publications, has been the subject of a glowing review in the LA Review of Books, and is so good that she's going to turn it into a book. Friends, a warm welcome for Katie Heindel. Katie, how are you doing today?
Dan, that's the nicest introduction I've ever received.
That's what I'm going for. The bar here is like, get people excited and happy right off the top so that they what I bring from here on out, they can at least have a long way to come down. That's the goal.
Well, it worked. I'm doing great, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy to be here.
All right. Well, we are happy to have you. And I've brought you here today to discuss emotional truths that have revealed themselves to us through the first month or so of the season. I've talked with folks like Zach Lowe and Tom Haberstroh about like tactical decisions we think will work and sample size stats and all that kind of stuff. But I want this show to be one where we talk about stuff that has nothing to do with math, too. Where we can talk about how what we are watching resonates in our bones. And for my money, there's no one in the world better at that than you. So you making some time for me today is a true treat. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we operate from a place of joy. So Katie, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
This is like, I swear it's not recency bias, but it literally happened last night from when we're recording this podcast. But it was Jimmy Butler narrating the Skya because it made me think, like, one, what if he just, this becomes his thing now, and he starts to narrate every single move that he does? And then what if, I was also thinking about like your Guyman quote, because I was like, what if this becomes a thing where the narration doesn't necessarily sync up to the move itself. The narration could be like bigger, broader, like not actually the thing. And then that also made me think that we've had this in NBA history. A move I also find really endearing is when guys scream and one, because it usually fails to materialize.
That's right.
So this is the more like heroic, like Jimmy makes it look so easy to just like, you know, call a skyhook and do it. Anyway, it brought me a great deal of joy.
That's tremendous. And that works very, very neatly. We're going to move into something about Jimmy in a little bit here. Actually, you know what? Let's just do it right now. Because you recently wrote about Jimmy Butler for SB Nation, a piece headlined, Jimmy Butler is changing the game by focusing on everything else. I know you've spoken to him before. You've written about him before. What makes him a particularly compelling figure through your lens?
I'm just like endlessly fascinated by Jimmy. One, because I feel like he would be a good hang generally. And I think, like, you know, you've probably found this, but that can be a rare thing, not just like in the NBA, but also like in life. I think sure. As you get older, you realize that. But what made me actually want to write that story, and this is like a thing I've been more fascinated with Jimmy for, probably since he's like found his footing in Miami and really, I think, become I would say like the person he seems to have been striving to become for like a lot of his NBA career is just this sense of individualism, but it's never at the expense of other people. It's like a genuine open curiosity. He's not afraid to make, to like look like an idiot. He's not afraid to like look like a novice. You know, I think of all the tennis he like took, took in this past summer. And just like the line that sticks with me most there was like, when he was like, I consider a lot of these people my friends. They don't know me. And I don't know if they would consider me their friends, but I would hope we could become friends. So just like, one, it's hilarious. Two, it is like kind of vulnerable. Three, I think that is the way you make friends. You have to like let the person know, especially when you're an adult. I'd like to be friends with you. There's no cool way of doing it. And then just like all these myriad other reasons of like, he's a coffee entrepreneur because it's something he got like super into and like goes and sources the beans and like wants to learn all these like really the minute process of like making coffee, you know, all the other stuff, like to go one step beyond. Jimmy just like always seems to want to go one step beyond the thing that he's interested in at the moment. Sometimes it's basketball, sometimes it's absolutely not basketball. He's also a maniac, and I really admire that in people because I recognize that quality of myself sometimes, but certainly not to that level. But yeah, I think Jimmy is just, he's a very interesting individual to me. And he just seems like a good, regular dude.
I think there's a lot in there. Well, the thing that it made me think of was my former editor, my friend Trey Kirby with the No Dunks guys and fans and friends of yours as well. He loves to say like, Jimmy just wants to work hard and be the man. And it's like, that's obviously an expansive, you know, it can mean a lot of things. But yeah, if what you are prioritizing is like, I want to, you know, work really hard and I want to be the best thing, the best that I can be at this thing. It also leaves like space for other stuff too. If you're not like, I'm burdened by a whole lot of specific nitty gritty here. Yeah, there's room for coffee. There's room for traveling to go see friends and teammates. There's room for, you know, lengthy dominoes and spades tournaments there. You know, there's room for a lot of that. And he seems to have chosen wisely on a lot of those things. It made me think, in what you said, like he's focusing on everything else. It made me think of the idea of focus. And obviously, Jimmy, a singularly focused competitor, but he also isn't necessarily always at the focus of the stories he's in. And I think it's rare to have people who are like equally compelling as the lead and as a supporting actor. And it made, like, I started just going back over it in my head. And like the last 10 or 15 years of NBA stuff, there's so many things where Jimmy just sort of weaves in and out. It's like the Zelig of the NBA. Like it's from his like early years at the Bulls to the, you know, the rise and fall of Derrick Rose and Tom Thibodeau to the Wolves, like all the way to now, like he's there for LeBron's retaking the throne and Jokic's coronation and all these sorts of things. Maybe it's not a coincidence that like you put a guy that interesting in a situation and it's going to produce drama at a high level. Like maybe he's secretly the best actor of the NBA for the last 10, 12 years.
It's possible, but I just feel like there's such a genuine thing. I mean, you make a really good point of like him being involved in everything else, because I found when I've been lucky enough to chat with him, like he's okay to talk about himself in a way when it's kind of directed, but he's so much more comfortable talking about like former teammates, kind of friends of his, and like really pumping them up and like really making sure you see them the way that he has and he does, which is just like a trait I appreciate so much. Not just as a writer, but as a person who it's like, when someone is that like thoughtful and notices those kinds of qualities in the people around them, like generally you assume they're pretty empathetic, like watchful person. Yeah, I don't know. I guess this is just gushing about Jimmy Butler, but.
Well, I mean, A, this is a podcast that is in part about that. And it's we're coming from a person who runs something called Basketball Feeling. So that's an okay. I think we're squarely in the bounds of this. But yeah, empathetic was the word that I was flashing on too. Because I was able to be around the Heat a little bit during the playoffs last year because they were here in New York and I saw them against the Knicks. I was down in Miami for a game in the Celtics series. And then at the finals, I was able to be around them. And the degree to which it's funny, you know, like, work hard and be the man. But his version of being the man is like, I need to big up everybody else. I need to not make it about me. It becomes about me if we all elevate. And so every time there's a conversation about how we, you know, we need to get to this place, it's always Bam is there with him. Everything coming out of his mouth is about how Bam is the star of the team and he's there alongside. And then whenever we are falling short, we will get there, and we will, because I know that I have all these guys who will do it alongside me. And some of that is, you know, maybe star speak and, you know, media training, but a lot of it seems to emanate genuinely from, this is the best way for us to all get what we need. And like, I kind of get that those guys need to know I believe in them no matter what. And that's, you know, there aren't a whole lot of superstars that necessarily exude that in the same way.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like with him, I've always had the impression he was really waiting to find this team for himself, you know, and like to find this fit and like genuinely striving. You know, I think of basically him in Chicago, like going to the front office and pleading, like pitching himself, right? Pitching himself is like, I'll be your guy. You can build this team around me. And then being like, haha, no. Which I'm sure now they're like, oof, we blew it. Right. You know, and in Minnesota, you could kind of see the same thing, but perhaps like tinged with a bit more frustration of who he had around him and where they were really at in the readiness and maybe willingness stage of their career. Like I once wrote for one of my like NBA Halloween fan fiction stories, I did write about the Timberwolves being like teen wolves. And I do believe that that team was that. Like they just wanted to play video games and like skateboard and like smoke weed. Maybe they didn't skateboard, but like in my mind. Anyway. And something like Jimmy,
a long way from work hard and be the man.
Yeah. That's frustrating, you know? And then he gets to Miami and he's like, oh wait, like everyone here is a maniac. Like that's what heat culture is. It's like maniac culture.
Right.
And now I can be the leader for that. Like this is sick. This rules. You know, this is something I really can comfortably lead. Because that's the thing. To me, it never felt like there was any acclimatization. He just kind of was like, well, you know, I'm here. And this is how I've been operating all along. And then they, even like someone like, I mean, you know, I'm like a Kyle Lowry diehard.
Sure.
But even someone like him coming in, finding a fit, I think of all these, like Kevin Love, it's like he's the least grumpy we've seen him in seasons in Miami, like finding a fit with that team. Yeah, it just seems to be like the perfect atmosphere for this guy. And maybe that's why now it seems like Jimmy Butler has all this, it's not like he has more free time, but he feels like a certain weight has maybe been taken off of his shoulders so he can go and explore like all this other stuff that he's interested in.
It's fascinating. And it's a piece that I would recommend everybody go check out, Katie at SB Nation writing about Jimmy Butler. And transitions neatly for us, the emotional truth of Jimmy finding his sort of best expression in Miami. I wanted to talk a little bit about stuff that we've seen over the course of the first, you know, few weeks here of the season. Not like, is this team for real or is this whatever, but like stuff when you watch, I know you are someone who focuses a lot on the smaller, quieter aspects of the game and, you know, a gesture here, an emotion there, something that maybe happens that doesn't necessarily track for everybody else, or that maybe points to something that you think is more interesting and beyond it. So I have a couple of ideas of like sort of things that emotional truths I have perceived that mean something to me. And I'm wondering, is there something like that that has stood out to you as from the early weeks of the season?
Quinn Snyder's red glasses. No,
okay. I was like, you can say that's a joke if you want, but we can get into that.
We can. That's like my loose example. I was just like, I'll kick myself if I don't remember to put that on record.
Why?
I'm obsessed with them. He doesn't seem to understand the power that they have over people. And it's not just me, like a Quinn enthusiast, to put it like safely. They're like, I don't know, because his eyes, you've been in rooms with him. He's an intense man. This certainly comes through on the broadcast, even if you haven't been in rooms with him. Something about the red glasses, it's just like bullseyeing the intensity in an even more pointed way. But they're also weirdly playful. And then when someone asked him about them, he was like, oh, I don't know, just red was an
this
option.
This old thing, right? Yeah.
Red was, it's like, you thought about this. You can't wear red glasses and not think like, oh, I picked this red frame because it looks amazing on me. I also am very interested in like the domino effect, because Joe Mazzulla, also got some glasses. Don't really have the same effect whatsoever. They remind me, and they, in fact, look exactly like a pair of yellow tinted glasses I think I got after I saw the movie Go in middle school and made my parents get for me. Not as powerful, kind of goofy.
So, but you know, this is a man who is famously intense and is now like charged with directing a somewhat aimless seeming Hawks organization that has a lot to figure out and play for. And he chooses to do so by both making himself a little more academic, but also looking like he has constantly shooting lasers at everybody that he's looking at, which maybe is why Trae Young is playing off the ball a little bit more. Who knows? Who can say?
Maybe. I'm so nervous to see him in person, Dan. Like when they come through Toronto, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to like take a back seat in that press conference.
It's great.
I don't trust myself.
Well, I'm fascinated by the work that's going to need to go into you getting there. I think that's I trust you as a professional. You will get there. But I want to know what the process winds up. So we'll have to talk about it after the fact.
Thank you.
One that I wanted to throw out, and you could tell me, I've written a bunch about this. So I'm interested in, you know, a person who's not been living inside of it for a little while. Jeremy Sochan learning how to play point guard in real time. It's like reminding me of why I like this and why I watch games and the league. The vulnerability you have to show as like an elite athlete on the highest level, the most competitive league in the world, to say, well, I have to do this thing that I've literally never done before, and it's going to be embarrassing, and I'm going to get made fun of, and every night I turn the ball over or don't get enough assists, people are going to say, they should play that guy. That guy over there knows what he's doing and is way better at it. And you have to just keep going at it and doing it and trying to learn this new thing. And the strength of character of being able to be like, yep, well, it stinks. And sometimes I want to say this, but like, I'm going to go do it is I keep the more I watch it and the more I think about it, the more not only like charming, but kind of genuinely inspiring I find myself thinking it is. That's also because I wound up watching a crazy amount of them and writing a lot about it. But I'm wondering, that sort of experimentation in real time, does that stir anything for you?
Yeah, I think it's like, one, I think it's really cool and kind of brave and shows a lot of confidence, you know, for what you're saying, the vulnerability to like, know you're going to mess, not just be like, I could mess up, but to know like, inevitably,
it's for sure going to happen, right?
A bunch of times. In one game, it's kind of the opposite of the Jordan Poole experience right now. I feel like something about the way Jordan Poole is going about this for the Wizards is opposite the way that Jeremy Sochan is going about this for the Spurs. Like, I just saw a video of Jordan Poole rolling the ball to half court because he didn't know. He thought the shot clock would also wait. And there's something about like, okay, you know, like you're in your fifth year, right, of like the NBA. Maybe you should know that by now. I don't know why I'm less like open to Jordan Poole making these mistakes. Maybe because the amount of bravado that he's shown and like that he really seems on that. And I'm not trying to make this all about Jordan Poole, I swear.
No, that's fine.
But like he seems to have gone the opposite direction again. We're being like, this is my team now. I'm going to run with it. But in doing so, he has like alienated the rest of the team. He's just playing basketball for himself, it seems like, in that he imagines he's the only person on the floor. Like, that's what I think of when I watch Jordan Poole play basketball this season so far. Sometimes Kyle Kuzma like flashes in the corner and he remembers like Kuzma's there. But otherwise, like nobody else exists. And like Jeremy, I think, what I've seen of him, I loved watching him in Summer League. I just kind of like love his general vibe of like, he, a little aside is in the summer, he didn't really get to like take that much vacation, you know, because I also have a vacation watch column.
This is true.
And I included him in the column to some argument from readers because he asked, he was like, I need to renovate my living room. I don't know anything about design. And I want it to look cool, but I also like, I want to have input. I don't just want to hire someone and like have them make this look like a place that I don't live in. So he's like, can anyone recommend me some people in the area? And something about it was just like, it's like, man, like, again, like this is what a normal person would do. You have you have a lot more money than normal people to just like hire someone and kind of leave this alone and, you know, disappear for a few weeks. But like, you want to be involved in this process that you know nothing about and you want to learn as you go. In a way, it's like what he's doing, playing point guard. But like, he just seems like someone who is open to making mistakes, open to wanting to like make the mistakes, because there's no better way, especially in the NBA, to learn a new skill than when you get burned so badly by messing up. Like, those are the harder lessons. We do see those lessons, like, usually night after night, some poor guy is going to mess up. But like, to then have the courage to keep making sustained mistakes in the hopes that at some point, whether that it becomes muscle memory, like you've gone through the action enough times that you'll remember like where to go from here, and like how to actually like execute a play properly. I don't know. I admire it. I admire it.
I also think it goes to the general experimental phase that the whole team and the franchise and the organization are in. Like, there, we saw to some degree the expected plan for the Spurs that we all understand the order of things. Like, it goes from Duncan, from Robinson to Duncan, and then through, you know, Manu and Tony, and then Kawhi. But then, like, trying to graft past plans onto different people with different mentalities or different, well, you know, goals or desires or wants or whatever, it doesn't always fit so neatly. So now they have this other, you know, in Victor Wembanyama, brand new sort of transformational guy who is, I think, very clearly been all about, like, I will not be put in a box. I might be the statement piece for the new kitchen, but like, or for the new living room, but like, I want to have some say on where I stand. And so rather, if the whole plane is going to be built out of, you know, expansive possibility and let's, you know, like, push out the boundaries of what we can be, then yeah, why not try this now? I understand the fan perspective that's frustrated. Like, this is, we're not winning and it looks ugly because of it. But I also, like, there's more, I don't know, sometimes there's more important things than winning right now and looking ugly in the process. And, but I mean, I can say that as somebody who doesn't like own Spurs season tickets. I suppose that makes some sense. But with that in place, the Jeremy Sohan discussion neatly tucked into our compartments, is there another emotional truth that has revealed itself to you over the course of the few weeks of the season?
Yes. I do have one more thing to add about the Spurs thing.
Oh, yes. By all means, please go.
One, I've had a lot of fun watching them. And to your point, like, sometimes when they have like pulled out a win, it's been in a really it's usually in a pretty novel, interesting, kind of gritty way where like everyone is trying really hard, but they're not losing sight of like, you know, we'll have another chance. I don't know. It sounds corny to be like, they're not losing sight of the fun of it, but that's genuinely what it feels like. And I want to say, like, it has also made me like Pop Moore, who in recent seasons I was like, you know, you're just like a grump all the time. And like, the bit of being a grump is sometimes gets old, a little bit stale, right? But like, with this team, he also seems to be like, I don't know, trying. It's weird to be like, he's trying new things for someone like him.
No, but it's absolutely.
Probably, yeah, like, done everything under the sun. But like, when you get to kind of listen in, whether it's like because he's mic'd or you just like watch kind of the game, like, he just seems to be happy to like watch and learn from these guys and to like, again, like, not take everything so severely and like wear it around his shoulders, which I think has been such like a mandate of the Spurs franchise, whether you like it or not, over the years. So that's been cool. Yeah, I think a dark example, I'm not trying to take it dark, but like, I had
that's,
a dark,
by all means, that's totally fine,
example of this quote, just in terms of like, what's real, what's not, how we can like convolute and twist the truth in a way that I don't actually understand with this example what it serves. But with Kelly Oubre Jr. getting hit by a car, and then immediately this, I don't understand the need or urge to like disprove what he said. Because even on the face of like reporting or journalism, I don't understand why that's the initial reaction, right? Like, this couldn't have possibly happened. And then to not think, well, maybe he is embarrassed, or maybe he, I don't know, fell off his bike, or maybe he, like, I don't doubt at all that he got injured. As someone who's literally been run over by a car before, it's a feeling. Sure. And you don't necessarily, I mean, I was knocked out, but like, you also don't necessarily remember in a straight line everything that happened. The fact that probably he leaked the footage of his own ring light, like of his door.
Yeah. The doorbell camera, right?
To TMZ. Because otherwise, like, how? Right? That's not like the skill. I know people are like, wow, TMZ, the skill is getting scary. But it's like, no, I think with that, like, he or someone around him definitely leaked it because there was doubt cast on like what happened. I just think that's such a strange impulse. And it, to me, it speaks to some of like the darker impulses. I don't want to tie everything up in betting, but like, there's definitely this feeling of like, well, what does it mean for me if X person is not available for X game? You know, right. It's everything isn't just about betting, but I just mean like, why is it your impulse as a person to disbelieve that a terrible thing happened to somebody else, you know? And like, what does it really serve? But like, you're in that, you're like, you are making the truth. You're making the fact like something else.
Yeah. I wonder if some component of it is tied up in that things with the 76ers sort of always seem to be weirder than they need to be, or like a little more convoluted. True. And maybe so if the idea is it would be a bad enough thing to have happened for him and for the team and for whatever else, just on its face to be like, well, this guy who was playing great for us had this horrible accident and now won't be able to play for a while. But with the like sort of meta story over the 76ers, it's like, but also what's the weirder thing underneath that? What's the darker thing underneath that? But yeah, I mean, anytime you get to a place where it's TMZ is broadcasting video of your home to prove or disprove or not even really shed dramatically more light on anything one way or the other, it's like, now we're through, not even through a looking glass. I don't know what we're through, you know, some kind of like a particularly
ring camera.
Yeah,
fisheye, like
right.
People, ring camera.
And you know, for that to be the place where the focus lies is never really a great thing. And yeah, I mean, but you're absolutely right. You know, you see players talk about it a lot. You know, there was a video of Jimmy from earlier this season. I think Overtime put it out, but where it's like he's sitting in the front row. And there, or he's on the court and somebody on the front row is saying to him, like, you need to, you know, score more than 15 tonight or whatever, because I need that for my parlay. And he's like, I don't give a damn about that. Like, you know, the guy's like, I need it to pay my mortgage. Jimmy's like, oh, I paid my house cash. So like, I don't know. It's not really my responsibility to do that. But yeah, you know, that, or, you know, oh, this like Jokic got ejected last night. There goes my fantasy lineup or whatever, you know? And yeah, the diversion of attention from where it, you know, should be or could be to other areas. And not just for, I mean, as you, the specific thing of what you mentioned is like, you need, like, there needs to be a gotcha attached to it. I don't know. And listen, maybe more will be revealed. Maybe more reporting does shed more light on it. But guy got hit by, got hit by car and is in bad shape. See, like, that's usually enough to be like, leave that story alone on its own, I think, to me. Mm-hmm. A shift from there for me. I think good is more interesting than great, and bad can be more interesting too. And so that's like the only great thing that I feel like I've seen so far, like undeniably, unquestionably great thing I've seen so far is the Celtics starting lineup. And fine. Like, yeah, I mean, I understand the pieces that fit together and why it's good. I analyzing why it's so successful one way or the other is great. Like, okay. Watching teams struggle is so much more interesting to me than that. Like, what, it, rather than frictionless excellence, I kind of like the sweat of the labor. There's like online friend Jason at Fraser Approves on Twitter wrote last week that he's likes this Knicks team just being good, even though it's not great. And the line that he wrote was, not every team can compete for a championship, and there's something to be said for fielding a good competitive team. I feel like nobody respects a good team anymore. The 90s Knicks, the early 2000s Trailblazers, grit and grind Grizzlies. Now you either go to the finals or you suck. And I think something gets lost in that. And maybe the KD era Warriors broke our brains in ways that are irrevocable. But the idea that you watch the Bucks not know how to play with Damian Lillard because he's a planet, you know, or you are watching, the Knicks be a team that like, well, we can't shoot at all. So we have to figure out how do you make a good offense out of you can't shoot? Or, you know, the Kings being phenomenal on offense, but terrible on defense, other teams having sort of divergent other issues. Styles make fights is kind of the most interesting thing and the most compelling drama that we have. So I kind of get sick of, we need to make everything as we have to find the solution that makes it perfect. And maybe it's a little more interesting to me to focus on the flaw and not even like to try to solve it, but just to see what it is and how it might interact with other teams' flaws. And maybe, you know, your round peg and their square hole makes for an interesting banging. I don't know, something like that. But it doesn't necessarily lead into, is there a flawed team that has been of particular interest to you so far?
Yeah, I'd say I'm actually only interested in flawed teams. I don't know if that's just the game. No, I think that's probably always true for me. I'm like, what's my favorite team? My favorite teams are like Pistons era underdog teams.
Sure.
Like, until the Raptors won the title and became my favorite weird mishmash of like guys. Anyway, I also like, to your point of like, we have to fix this. I think there's always this like cyclical, like made up struggle of there'll be kind of peaks and valleys in the NBA. And then the urge is we've got to smooth the topography out like this. We need to streamline it. And it's like, why? The kind of jagged edges and rough patches are what I think makes a season compelling and also like adds to the storyline of the season for teams, for individual athletes. Like without that, it starts at its arbitrary start date and it ends with the finals. Maybe some people do want to watch basketball that way. I don't. I love games that are like super sloppy. I love a double OT for no reason. Right? Like, and not even in a quote important game between two teams, just like really duking it out. That is so much more compelling to me. I also think it's like, I had to watch the Celtics the other night when they were in Toronto, and I texted Josh Gondelman and I was like, it sucks. It sucks watching the Celtics. And he's like, it sucks. He's a Celtics fan.
A very like, big one. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, we were specifically talking about Kristaps Porzingis being such a huge part of that lineup. And yes. How just like, I hate watching that. I also like an evil part of me is like, this is it's going to fail at some point. Like, I don't believe that for him, this is just as an athlete and the way that he fits into rosters can have a 180 completely. So anyway, but I like elements of the Celtics, you know, I'm a late comer to Jason Tatum. But I enjoy watching him now. I like Jaylen Brown quite a bit. But yeah, man, like that team is just, it's not that compelling to me. I'd rather watch the Pacers go breakneck, you know, on like a Tuesday night because that's just their style of play now. They're so fast. They're like halfway up the floor before whatever team they're facing understands what's happening, that they've even inbounded the ball. Like that is so much more fun to me. This is something I've like got into with Raptors people of just like having to, how difficult it is to sometimes understand that the team you're covering or rooting for is going to be competitive in a way you haven't known them to be in a long time. That is, some nights they're going to be awful. Some nights they're just going to be fine. They're just going to be good, you know, to your point. They're not probably actually going to have many, if any, great games this season. But like having to adjust to that and set your expectations accordingly, you're probably going to have a lot more fun and like find more worthwhile, whether you're working, so you'll find more worthwhile stories out of that. And I think as a fan too, like you're probably going to have a less miserable season. So yeah, I think like and we talked about the Spurs already, like that's another team again, where it's just like the wins I've loved is when they're like, we don't really know what we're doing, but we're going to try something out here. Or like everybody else has written us off and like, we're going to give it a go. And they get to win that way. I don't think it is abundantly clear to me. And I hate that I'm even about to say this. Like because I'm like, why are we even talking about it yet? But like, sure. Who's even going to be in playoff contention this season?
Right.
The East is just a quagmire again. the West, I don't really believe, like, you know, the Suns, we haven't even seen all those guys play together yet, right? Like the big components of like their star core, like they haven't all played together yet. So I don't know what's happening there. You know, the Nuggets will like kind of travel along beautifully as they did last season. But it's sometimes not fun. This sounds so sad to watch like consistently beautiful, like methodically beautiful basketball. You know?
No, I absolutely get what you're talking about. No, that was sort of the, I understand it is good to celebrate when something like beautiful is happening, like that there's no downside to that. But you're not like, what if what you're watching for is just to celebrate perfection or pursuit of it, like I feel like you're missing a whole lot of the frame of the painting, right? Like as you said, the rough brushstrokes are the ones that kind of that should draw your eye and then make you think for a little bit longer about it. And the fact that, yeah, there's you know, half the league is whatever between like 9-5 and 5-7 or something mm-hmm. like that. Like it's because there's so like it is in, you know, rock, paper, scissors almost every night. And this team's good at X, that team's bad at Y. And how does that interact? And then those dynamics completely shift night to night. That's why it's worth watching all of these teams. And like there are individual players that are going to jump off the page. You know, you mentioned the Pistons before. Like you get to just watch Asar Thompson and or you watch like Jaden Ivey starting to sort of figure out pace, or, you know, Cade Cunningham hearing everybody talk about how he can't get to the free throw line and then taking 11 or 12 of them last night. And like there's all this real time progress or grinding the gears to try to get somewhere new. That's the stuff that's worth it. Like that's the good stuff. That's not, we'll have plenty of time to you know, highlight how awesome it is that team was, you know, 16-4 in the playoffs and, you know, what that means for everyone's legacy. But like night to night, give me something entertaining. And I don't know. Yeah. I think that's, now Celtics fans can argue with me all they want that their team is more entertaining, and that's fine. You're within your rights to do it. But
it probably is to them, just, you know, to some Celtics fans, like that's what they want to see, right? Like a franchise that has almost gotten to the precipice so many seasons in a row, they don't want to see struggle anymore. They want a smooth sail because their struggle is coming. Like their struggle might just end up being the same sticky point in the postseason as they've had for like season over season. But yeah, like the upsets are just so much more even like telling to me. Like we're talking about what's entertaining, but I also find like, why, like, are the Warriors really unhappy? Like, that's what I think when I see Draymond Green dragging Rudy Gobert down the floor and then Steve Kerr being like, no, he did what he had to, like, or Steve Kerr being like, it wasn't a great visual, but like, that's all that was like his, just
as far
visual.
As you can go. Yeah. The content, we're not going to focus too much on that.
But like, why is Klay Thompson so mad? I thought people around the league loved Klay. It doesn't seem like that's the case anymore. Like he seemed like he was kind of like the goofy, bro-y, everybody's everyman. You know, Steph's out. Draymond seems miserable, or so, if not, I don't want to say like he's miserable. I don't know him, but it just seems so like out of step, you know, and it's like this team is aging. That's like a whole question. Like, what's happening there? So again, like you see more of the blips and the rough stuff, like that kind of stuff is more telling than if a team is just carrying along and it looks like, you know, a duck, like surface level, just like smooth sailing, legs kind of going like crazy under the surface. But with a team like the Warriors, the duck is flipped over and you see the struggle like above the surface. You can learn so much more about what's going on with a franchise that way.
Absolutely. And you're taught, you know, the word that keeps flashing in like bright, like a neon sign in my brain as we're talking about this is narrative, right? And it has become
my love hate word. Yeah.
Well, okay. So I was gonna say it's become a real dirty word for a lot of fans, and maybe a specific kind of fan or analyst that's like, it's not, you know, you're just trying to sell a story about what's happening with this. Whether it's is or is not supported by the underlying data, but like, the reason that we get to this, that we care about this stuff, is because it does tell us a story about these individual people, about these teams. The Warriors are, this is a very interesting point in their narrative arc. Like to go from the upstarts in 2014, and then, you know, ride in the crest of the top of the league, and then the down of the injuries and back up. And now it's like, are they at the end of something, or is it the start of something new? Is Steph now just sort of, is he separating from the booster rockets that were with him the whole time because he can keep going and they maybe can't? Like, all of that stuff is fascinating to watch. And so for it to be like, no, well, let's primarily focus on whether or not that's a good look for the league, or whether or not it's about, you know, what lineup combination would best maximize whoever. Like, I write about that stuff too, and I focus on that stuff too. But the bigger story is the more interesting one to talk about, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also love your analogy of like Steph the Rocket, because it is like Clay and Draymond are like succumbing to their own gravity in the league, which is like now pulling them way down. But narrative is just interesting to me because I think it's so funny to me. I mean, as a writer and just, you know, someone who looks around and like your day-to-day life, like how you explain like your day to your loved ones, like you know, that's the way you stitch all these like dumb little things that happen to you if you're out in the world and you come back. And like for you, Dan, I'm sure you tell your wife this. For me, like, you know, I tell my husband this, but it's like it's narrative. Like you make a story. Like we are compelled to put things together in a linear way that makes sense. So I think, you know, narrative having become such an ugly word in just the NBA context is so interesting to me. And it also, I know it folds into like this distrust of quote like media as sure. Like as almost like a secret society. Like we're all in cahoots and we're all trying to, you know, push certain things and certain stories. But like narrative is, it's just story. Like narrative is how we understand the world around us. It's certainly an easier way, a more straightforward way sometimes to understand basketball. And I think, you know, we like to tell stories. We like to write about people and teams and what's going on there. It is just one narrative. And I think maybe for people who aren't a fan of that word or use it in a way to like, you know, antagonize what it is.
Yeah, as like an insult or disparaging. Yeah.
It's like, well, okay, sure. But it's still just no one is telling you that this is the only way you need to understand or interpret something. Right? It's just one way.
I want to come back to that. We're going to come back to that because that's it reminds me of something that you wrote about something somebody else said very recently. But is there another emotional truth that you wanted to share before we transition?
Yeah, I'll bring it just to a light, quick one. And this is one that I'm really, actually, it's light on the surface, but I'm really grappling with it. But it's the Mavs franchise becoming likable and even endearing in their social spots. So I guess just like kudos to the Mavs social team, but like that boot, I don't know if you saw the like Body by Luka.
Yes,
video.
I did. Like,
dude, also we're talking about like vulnerability and, you know, being goofy and not being afraid to like look kind of silly and dumb. And like, I don't think you can really underestimate how hard that is for especially professional athletes, because they're always told like not to act that way. So to get everyone on that team really to like buy into dressing up like you're in an 80s workout video. And also just like a vaguely like, it's kind of like sexy. Like it's kind of like, I don't know, it's uncomfortable for sure, but it's very funny. And then also like, I think of their media day photos when they had Luka in like Elton John star sunglasses, yep, holding a guitar, just like a nice funny Polaroid that you're just like, just looks like, you know, you and your friends goofing off. Luca's mustache in general, I'm not saying that his facial hair has to be a bit, but it certainly fits into just this like new look, fun personality Mavs. And like, this is antithetical to like everything I've ever known and thought about the Mavs organization with its many problems, and also yes, like Mark Cuban in general, and also trying to run your basketball team like a analytics like robot. Anyway, so I guess just, yeah, kudos to whoever is doing that, because it is literally changing to me how I will remember, you know, like I can feel it in real time, smoothing over and changing the image of like what the Dallas Mavericks are to me.
And with Luka as the focal point of that, because what was the conversation, the most frequent conversations coming into seasons and then like as seasons progress with him, it's, well, okay, he's the MVP favorite. Well, he's out of shape. well, everyone seems mad and he's leading the league in technical fouls and he's getting thrown out of games and he's looking up at the refs and making money signs with his hands to suggest that they're, and it's like, well, how do we, and then even this summer, you know, in FIBA, Slovenia against Canada, he gets thrown out of that game fighting with Dylan Brooks. And there's more of that thing. Like, man, when is this guy going to like, get past the part where like, I'm against everybody and everybody's against me. And it's like, well, he comes into the season in great shape. He's in a good mood. He's got a fun facial hair configuration, which I mean, I can say I haven't changed this one dramatically in a long time, but every once in a while, it's fun to shake it up. And they, so much of it maybe goes to context too. The team around you, when the team, it feels like, when it feels less like you have to drag the team to where you need to go and more like the team is augmenting you. So, oh, I have a rim runner in Derek Lively. We've got more like wing guys that can defend. Tim Hardaway Jr. is now like freed and unshackled to gun unrepentantly, which is, yeah, I love that for him. Absolutely. And like, you know, Kyrie is, has been like since day one, this is his team and I'm going to fit along, and then has sort of kept to his word on court in that way. Yeah. There must be a lightness of being that also then goes to, oh, well, maybe it changes the way I look at that guy. Who, and this is something that Vincent Goodwill and Jason Goff talked about on Good Word with Goodwill on Monday's podcast on the Ball Don't Lie Network. It was that sort of idea of when guys are reaching their time, like they're sort of on a clock. A superstar has only a few years before it's like, all right, the highlights are cool and let's get serious now. Mm-hmm. And Luka's squarely in that space. Like, all right, you got to a conference finals. Great. But like, you need to start winning bigger for us to remember you in whatever way you want us to remember you. That's got to be an awful lot of pressure to feel and to carry. And so then to be like, well, what if I carried it a little more lightly? Seems, whether that's a conscious choice or not, the presentation matters too. So, and then, you know, oh, by the way, the Mavs are actually off to a really good start and have looked pretty good. Maybe, you know, maybe it's a rising tide that lifts all boats. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just generally, I'm shocked that Kyrie agreed to be in that video, but he did.
I mean, listen, you got to take it when he says, you know, I'm about the team here. Like, I understand it is difficult to take this particular guy at his word, but, you know, actions mean more than words, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And here we see that. So, all right. Well, Katie, before we get out of here, we go to a segment we like to call the closing five. It's a little something, five questions, because how you start is not as important as how you finish in the NBA and here on the Divine Intervention podcast. Question one. Who's your dream feature interview? If it's basketball, great. If it's not basketball, that's great too.
Oh, probably Kyle Lowry. Yeah.
Okay. Why Kyle Lowry?
Because I think he doesn't like talking to media. He did definitely warm up on media in Toronto when just before he left, but it was more in like open kind of scrum situations. So I think to actually like sit down with someone like that, I think his path was so interesting. I don't deny that it was like tied very much to my own fandom. And it's really rare to have that, I think, as a fan. And then someone who comes to like work alongside something, but to see someone's arc, you know, and have it so much lined up with, I don't know, huge swaths of your own life. But like going from someone who was considered like team kryptonite, right? Like coach kryptonite right. in his early days, getting kind of shuttled around, expecting to probably just get jettisoned off the Raptors like ASAP, and then kind of being asked to buy into something by a stranger who became like one of his best friends, and then goes on to like lead and soften and really just like become so vocal about the way he loves and cares for his teammates. I just, again, I don't think that's something we get to see that much. And I think just the maturation is very interesting to me. He just seems to me like a very thoughtful, caring person who's had some like real ups and downs, you know, in life and in basketball. And he's funny.
And yeah, there's absolutely something to like you getting somebody when they've actually got some perspective on the things that they've experienced, as opposed to when they're right in the middle of them. Mm-hmm. Often it seems like a nice time to talk to somebody. So Heat, you heard her, set it up. Let's get that going. question number two, what's the last live performance you attended?
Oh, like a band?
Band, theater, comedy, whatever.
This is sad. I can't even think of it. Oh, it was probably Bikini Kill.
Ooh, okay. How was that?
It was good. They had to postpone like twice in Toronto because like the first time I think was during pandemic the second time years later was everyone in the band got COVID. And it just like never fit back into their tour legs. So I think they just came and did a one-off. It was a good show. There was a lot of kids that got brought by their parents, which I thought
parents
was kind of
their,
nice.
That yeah. is really yeah. cool. That's so I have two daughters, 1 9, 1 6, and we have not yet lined up the timing on those things. Very much looking forward to that. If for no other reason, then they can be like, I can't believe
sucks.
I have to come here with
yeah,
you.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
But like, no, I don't think any of the kids really enjoyed it, but it was like, you know, kudos for trying.
It will always have been the story they got to do, right? Like, what yeah. was your first show? I was Bikini Kill when I was like 9. No big deal. Who cares? question 3. During a recent visit to the Old Man and the Three, JJ Redick's podcast, Adam Silver raised a frustration with a lot of NBA media coverage. His quote was, "I think sometimes the color commentary in our game gets reduced to this team wanted it more or this team tried harder, as opposed to there's really complex defenses. What's the offense like? Explain what's happening on the court." You wrote a really thoughtful sort of response to it, or a meditation on that idea at Basketball Feelings. It included a line that I loved. Making basketball commentary more tactically descriptive doesn't make it more intelligent. It just assumes everyone's interested in interpreting the game in one specific way. What kinds of interpretations do you wish we saw more in the broader commentary?
Emotional interpretations. I mean, I know it sounds like a bit and like, oh, of course she would say that. But I mean, I write the way I write and have a newsletter called Basketball Feelings for a reason. Like it does go, it feels bit-ish sometimes when people are like, you're the feelings expert. Cause like, no, I'm not. But I think that, you know, more empathetic, broader commentary. And by broader, I mean something that looking at things and trying to take into account, like that they are in flux, especially when we talk about like the more serious things in the NBA, whether that's like, you know, allegations of intimate partner violence and things like that. It's like they exist at a moment in time, but you have to look at what happened before, what's happening now, and what may come after. I think to just have like a 360 more empathetic, I think an intelligent understanding of, you know, what's going on and what it means. I think so often, and I know why we do this, because it's like a lot of this comes down to plays and, you know, the way we rewatch things in basketball and just being focused on things like existing statically in time, but that's not true of people, and people play basketball. So I think, you know, this goes for the more serious stuff as it goes for the lighter, more fun stuff. But I think just like, yeah, kind of a 360 far-reaching look at why things are. And I mean, a simple example is like if somebody has a shitty night, to not be like their career's over or they don't care about their team.
Right.
Or like,
right.
I don't know, other stuff could be going on in their lives or with the team, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I think I get that's probably not the most compelling thing on TV, but I think it's not a really difficult thing to do.
Well, okay. if there can be time for like every joke that gets made on every pregame show and halftime show and postgame show and everything, and I'm glad that I like jokes a lot. There could also be time for an empathetic understanding of like, yeah, well, maybe that guy is like dragging a, you know, a hurt leg or something else happened. I think that the idea that there can't be space for all of it is limiting in a way that I don't think makes a whole lot of sense. And honestly, it's something that I think about a lot in my own work. Like, I feel like I've moved a little bit more in a descriptive explanatory framework in my writing, and maybe that's also part of the reason why when they asked what kind of podcast do you want, I was like, feelings. Fake therapy.
I mean, like, anyway. I guess my ulterior motive in that is that because if broadcast people in a broadcast media position, if writers talk about this, if anyone like whose job it is to kind of critique the game, and that's how a lot of fans, that's their lens to the game, signal that these things are important, that has a trickle down effect, right? Like that sure. will then, I think, make fandom a bit more of a empathetic thing in return. Like it kind of has to, is that you're saying like, no way, like we should give space and room and time and consideration to these things. I'm hearing and watching other people do that. Maybe that's important. I don't know. Maybe that's naive, but that's how I feel.
It's a good feeling. Question number 4. Thursday is Thanksgiving here in the States. I know not in Canada, but mm-hmm. It means we are now on the conveyor belt through the holiday season. Christmas approaches, etc. And for a lot of folks, that means a ratcheting up of stress and anxiety. What is a way that Katie Heindel likes to blow off steam?
Oh, first I got to say Thanksgiving, old news. We had that month ago. swimming is a big one for me. Like kind of plodding along in the medium lane at community lane swim definitely helps me. Lately I've been finding just like going for walks, which is feels like such a pandemic like holdover, but
going for a walk outside is not such a bad one.
It's not a bad one. Mostly because I think tied to writing a book, I found like I'm getting like doubly bogged down in writing, I don't know, annoyances and kind of issues that I had before, but those are amplified. So I read somewhere like if you're feeling anxious, like a walk is kind of an immediate, just your brain has to go somewhere else because you're focusing on someone else. So I have two dogs. They are not ever mad about getting taken out on a walk. Sure. There's a lovely like foot trail that runs pretty much like adjacent to the building that I live in that can go like really far if you care to do it. So probably that. Those aren't the most exciting, but that's where I'm at, Dan.
Listen, we all need things that are not exciting, but that are beneficial to us. And swimming laps in the lane pool and going out for walks there are a hell of a lot worse things you can do to blow off steam. I probably do a handful of them myself. Question number five. As we've established, I'm a huge fan of your writing, and I want to emphasize specifically your writing style. I feel like you put words together in ways that always make me very happy and make me go like, damn, I wish I had done that or could do that. So this is also a recommendation engine, divide intervention. Who are some people whose work regularly makes you do that? Go like, damn, I wish I thought of that, or I love the way that's put together.
In basketball, Dan, probably you.
Oh, stop. Cut this out, John.
Okay. No, don't take it out.
Okay, all right. Okay, fine. Keep going.
Okay. Sirit Sohi, Rob Mahoney, Colin McGowan.
Yes.
Kind of infrequently for Real GM, but when he does, it's always a banger. Kelly Dwyer, because Kelly will just like spin off into worlds that, you know, you're like, where are you taking me? But I'm happy to follow you. If someone is kind of taking me around writing like that, then that I genuinely like that, where, you know, it feels surprising and kind of novel every time. So yeah, probably those are my top. Not basketball writing. I'm a big fan of Jhumpa Lahiri. I just have this handy.
All right.
Her new book of short stories. She just said for something to do, learned Italian and moved to Italy and then started writing in Italian. So she and then translated Italian. So that book she wrote in Italian and then translated herself to English. Why not? I guess, why not?
It's an extreme flex. That's pretty impressive.
It is. It's like Jimmy Butler maniac, but like for an author. Miriam Taze is like another author I love. But yeah, generally these people have a great knack for one sentence you're kind of like laughing, and like maybe in the same sentence you're choking up about something. But just as you said, like putting words together and kind of observations together in a way that is, it's just gonna like take you out of yourself.
These are wonderful recommendations. I will ask you then, is there an additional, we'd like close out the show with a weekly recommendation. It can be about, does not have to be about basketball. Previous examples have included like the histories of Herodotus and making baked ziti. So is there something that you think is good and cool that the listening public would enjoy or make their day 1% better?
Yeah, go to your library. Go to like your local library.
Yes, I almost did this. Okay. All right, I'm glad I didn't because I want to hear you do it. All right, go for it.
My recommendations have just been like wholesome as hell, and I have to.
That's
it's making
fantastic.
Me sound like a better person than I am. But in writing the book and like realizing like sometimes I'm not going to do my best work at home. Sometimes I need to leave. There's a wonderful institution in Toronto called the Toronto Reference Library, which is like a 5-story huge library downtown in the city. But there they have like rare book archives. They have archives of like all the city's like historic photographs. They have like historic photo archives from everything else. There's music scores. There's like there's reading rooms. There's like events there. I just try and go find like a seat I like and I can pull books loosely about the things I'm writing about. Like, you know, the other day I went to write, but I spent like 2 hours reading about Japanese art. It's relevant to the book, I swear, but it's very nice to like have these kind of like tactile touch points. So if you get stuck in writing, you can, you know, just read and you still feel like, at least I still feel like I'm productive and I'm doing something to the end product. But in general, I will say like when I visit cities, I was just in San Francisco not that long ago. And then in LA on the same trip, I went to libraries for no reason other than I passed them. And I like just like going into these spaces and seeing how other cities are kind of like have their libraries. Libraries are important. I think like cultural institutions, I think they also reflect kind of like the health of any given like neighborhood and also like the social services within that. And they're really vital and they only exist through people using them, which is also a really cool thing, right? They don't exist to just be idle, quiet spaces. Some parts of them are, but like libraries are not that. So I don't know. I love the hold system in Toronto. I'm putting a million books on hold all the time. Right. Just like I love a library. So I can't thank a library enough. So go to your library. They're cool places.
This is incredible. I'm very, very happy that this happened. Yeah. In New York, we are currently in a moment where Mayor Eric Adams is proposing a budget cut that will include closing libraries on weekends. And Mayor Adams, I'm sure you're listening. Please reconsider that. And we could find the money elsewhere. I'm sure there are other major municipal budgets.
Gorgeous libraries too in New York.
We do. And yeah, there are places you can go for free and kids can have a lot of activities there. And it's, yeah, there's a million wonderful things about it. So yes, wholeheartedly agree. Now I feel a little silly because that was not only wholesome, but also really actually enriching to people's lives. Pablo Torre
basketball
on his new
can do both.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Oh, an important reminder. Pablo Torre on his new show, Pablo Torre Finds Out, interviewed the rapper and TV show host Action Bronson. It was a great and very funny interview. I enjoyed it very much. I like Action Bronson's music. And so hearing him in this sort of context was very funny. In particular, there is a moment where Pablo introduces Action Bronson to the social media account Accidental Bronson, which is an account that pulls lines that people have written that sound like they could be lyrics from Action Bronson songs because they are particularly unique. Like the idea of, you know, doing lines off of a Nintendo Switch in the back of a Hyundai Sonata or something like that. And very specific and silly. And Action Bronson was not aware of it. And he was reading them out loud and going like, that one does make sense for me. This one does not make sense for me. Now that one isn't quite. They've actually really tapped into what I do here. And hearing him evaluate the sort of processing and then recontextualizing of his art back at him in real time was a very interesting and very funny thing. And Pablo Torre is a wonderful host who is very good at moving that along and keeping Bronson engaged with it. So if you have not listened to that or if you've not seen it, there's a million clips of it on social media and you can find it on the Pablo Torre Finds Out feed. I highly recommend it. It was a very funny way for me to spend a few minutes. And I hope that I can help you guys find funny things and good ways to spend a few minutes too, even if it's not quite as high-minded as going to your local library, which I also endorse. Speaking of things that I endorse, I also wholeheartedly recommend and endorse that you subscribe to Basketball Feelings, basketballfeelings.substack.com, and that you check out the Basketball Feelings podcast wherever you are listening to this. Past guests include Dan Devine. Maybe you check that out. Katie, anything else that you would like to point people toward?
Nope. You did a great job.
Well, first off, I just need a clip and save that. You did a great job, Dan. Just keep that on a post-it right behind me. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. Thank you to Katie Heindel for taking all of this time to be with us today. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro. Is that right? John Gennaro?
Good enough.
It's not good enough. If I do John Gennaro.
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 We could do this all day.
Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make the show look and sound great. If you have made it this far, please subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube or whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on. Leave us a 5-star review. It helps us with discoverability and building the show. Thank you for listening. We will see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.